Good. Sorry, I actually hung up on you. I meant to close my browser.
No, no, that's okay. That's okay. No worries at all.
Okay. Great. If you have any questions, we can happy to answer any. Otherwise, we can just get right down to it.
No, I mean, I think you gave me a pretty good idea of what we'll be talking about. So that's totally fine. Right, and just so you know, you can call me Jeff. I go by Jeff.
Jeff. Okay. Perfect. All right. So, sorry, it's one little technical thing I need to check here, just that we are currently being recorded.
Sure.
That I once or twice it didn't record, and oh my god, was that a nightmare?
Oh,
but,
no, yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, we're good.
Awesome.
Okay, so let's start with your year of graduation, including if it was like spring, summer, fall, and your major.
Okay, it was spring 2009, and I was a professional music major with a concentration in mostly music business, CWP classes, and performance.
Concentration? That sounds like three completely different things.
Yeah, well, that's professional music for
all of Berkeley.
Yeah, that's kind of what it ended up being, but that major let me graduate a year early with transfer credits and, you know, AP classes and test outs, so that's what I decided to do.
Very cool. Oh, what was your principal instrument?
Drum set.
Nice. All right, so we'll get to your history later. But for now, tell us about your current job. What do you do? Where do you do it?
Sure. So in May, my wife and I moved to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And
meaning a couple weeks ago or a year ago?
I'm sorry, a year ago.
Okay.
It's hard to believe it's been a year. That's why I still say May. But it has been a year. So I'm a fine wine sales representative for a wine and spirits wholesaler called Breakthrough Beverage.
Gotcha. And when you say wholesaler, so it's not a producer. It's like you're getting wines from multiple places and then selling them to other retail outlets. Is that correct?
That's exactly it. The federal law for alcohol sales after prohibition is a three-tier system. So someone makes it, and then someone in the middle brokers it to someone who sells it to consumers. So I'm in that middle tier.
Gotcha. And what did you say the name of your company was?
It's Breakthrough, B-R-E-A-K-T-H-R-U.
Gotcha.
And Beverage.
Sure. So how large a company is that? You could give it in terms of revenue and or employees.
Sure. So in Pennsylvania, we do somewhere around 6 million cases per year. I'm not sure what the exact revenue is, but that's a large – we're the second largest player in Pennsylvania. And nationally, we're in about 20 markets, so 20 different states.
Gotcha.
And our company is the result of a merger between a very big Midwest company and a very big kind of New York East Coast-based company.
Understood. How many folks are in the Pennsylvania office where you work?
I'd say about probably about 60 in the office and about 40 in the field.
Mm-hmm. And what's your specific job there?
So specifically, our office is in Montgomery County, which is one outside of Philadelphia, but I'm based in Philly. Mm-hmm. So I only have to go to my office about once a week, which is an hour away.
Okay.
But I'm based in Philly, and in this state, I can't sell to what we call off-premise, which means like a wine store, because it's all controlled by the state. So there's just one person in the state capitol who picks all the wine for all the wine stores. That's a little funny. So that means that I only deal in the on-premise, which means restaurants. So that's somewhere that you go to consume a beverage on the premises, if that makes sense.
Yep. So bars, yeah, bars and restaurants.
Bars, restaurants, you know, anything like that. In the summer, we have some pop-ups in Philly, which is cool, like beer gardens and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the very basic outline of what I do is travel to those accounts and try to sell my products in.
Gotcha. So not going to ask how much you made, but I'm curious about your pay structure. Are you on commission, or is there like some hybrid of commission and salary?
It's a really complicated pay structure, because the straightforward thing to do is commission, and that's how it. If I was still in Massachusetts, in Boston, all of our sales reps there are on commission. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, I have a base salary, and then I have an opportunity to earn 15% of that salary in bonuses.
You said 15-1-5.
Yep, 1-5.
Okay.
So we work in 2-month cycles, mm-hmm. and we have certain goals during each cycle, because our suppliers, the people who we represent in the state, have expectations of our performance as a company. Does that make sense?
It does.
Cool. So if I achieve a sufficient amount of goals in each of those cycles, I get a piece of the bonus. So it's that 15% number divided by 6. And I can get that 6 times to total 15%.
I get it. Because it's one-sixth of the year. So it's like you got one-sixth of your regular pay, you'd get one-sixth of the bonus.
Exactly. So, and in addition to that, there's sometimes other incentives. Placing certain products, if you sell a case somewhere, you'll get $25 with no cap, so... You know, that kind of stuff adds up throughout the year, too.
Hey, do you mind sharing what your, let's say, monthly quota is?
As far as revenue or cases?
I guess. I don't even know how many, like, things are in a case. I'm sure it depends on whether you're talking large bottles or...
Yeah.
I was thinking revenue.
Sure. So, I'm in a pretty new territory. Mm-hmm. So there was someone who worked in Philly before me, and they got so many accounts that they couldn't really start any new business. So I'm working with those new accounts. We've grown from looking at about a goal of $11,000 in 2 months to now about $38,000 in 2 months.
$38,000. And I assume that the $38,000 2 months, or what's that, just under $20,000 a month, that's sales. But is this sort of like in accounts where then... What happens, because I'm thinking there's got to be, quote, residuals, right? Once you set up business, presumably
exactly.
They keep buying.
Exactly, and that's the goal. It's extraordinarily competitive in Philadelphia. There are so many companies that do what we do. So it's really a battle for market share in most cases. Mm-hmm. So... What you said is 100% correct, and there's no way to build on your success unless that does happen, but there's still a certain amount of effort required to make sure that someone else doesn't come in and take your call them placements, so they don't take your placement because you haven't checked in or been there or kept that relationship active for a while.
Sure. So, in other words, but when you're talking this 38,000 2 months, obviously it's going to be harder as you're newer. But at some point, a lot of that is just going to be current customers continuing.
Exactly. And as I said, when I first started, it was about 11,000 in 2 months, which was realistic at that point in time. So it builds, and that's the idea, is that everything from the number of cases to the revenue is going to build over time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And they acknowledge that in your pay structure, which is nice.
Exactly. I think the pay structure, although it is very complicated, as I'm sure you would agree, having just heard it, it's definitely fair.
Very cool. So, hey, can we can I ask in terms of the sales, like, how many deals do you typically make in a month? I'm sure they vary in size.
Sure. That's a pretty good question. I could try to think of a good week and multiply it by four. Maybe as far as new placements.
Yeah, I'm just sort of curious as to, how, because you gave us a number of more, just under $20,000 a month. But yeah, in terms and just over 5,000 when you just started out. So yeah, in terms of like new deals.
Yeah,
I'm just curious, like, 5,000 bucks, is that like $5,000 deals? $250 deals?
So think of an average case of wine. Most of the wine that any restaurant uses is what we call by the glass. So they're the things that you go in and you have a menu and they'll pour you one glass of it. Mm-hmm. And that ranges, in Center City, Philly, it could be, $12 to $16 a glass, and out in South Philly and North Philly, maybe more like 8 to 12, so it depends. But let's say an average bottle for that costs about $12, so that's $144 a case. Okay. If I went to an account and got a placement and they bought a case, that's a big win. Once I establish a relationship with them, I'd say a big win would be, we've placed like three wines by the glass and some stuff by the bottle, and you build a, $750 order in a week for everything.
Right.
So it just depends on your relationship with the account and, what kind of wines you're talking about. Of course, the math is pretty easy. Is it better to sell six bottles of $10 wine or two bottles of $50 wine,
Right. Hey, just curious, let's not go too deep into your history at this point, but I am curious, like, are you a wine guy? I mean, let's say prior to this job, were you particularly cognizant about wine? Or?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll kind of give the teaser, and then when you're ready, we'll go into the whole history. But I worked in the admissions office after I graduated Berkeley, and I was down the street from Bauer Wine and Spirits, which is on Newbury Street, in between Mass Ave and Hereford.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of it, as not necessarily through that store, although I did go there sometimes, but my interest in especially beer at that time and wine and spirits was really on fire and growing. And that was eventually the catalyst for me to go to Bauer Wine and Spirits and kind of start this new career.
Gotcha. Understood. So, perfect. Hey, could you sort of take us, like, a typical deal, as you said, you build a relationship, they usually start with a small order, then assuming that all goes well, it becomes more later. But sort of, how long does that whole relationship building take? Because I've spoke with people who do sales, right? And I've spoke with people who a typical deal could take 6 months to brew up and they hope to do three or four deals a year. And then I spoke with someone whose job was to sell $79 software. So you call and 5 minutes later, you've either made the sale or you move on.
Yeah, it kind of lives somewhere in between that. And that's a really good question. So like I said, it's extremely competitive. And for that reason, I mean, there's no restaurant in the world that doesn't already have wine, unless they just opened. You know what I mean? Everyone has it already. So you have to convince them that they should either add more or take something away and replace it with something you have. So to even get most respected, wine buyers in the city to talk to you, you have to go in four or five times before they even take you seriously. And, that first time might be when they're kind of setting up, you just pop in and say, oh, hey, I just wanted to introduce myself and leave them alone. So that's a cold call.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe you go in for lunch one day and you talk to the bartender for a while and make an ally. And then they tell you, oh, hey, this is when you can usually catch the person you want to see. And you go back a third time and they say, I'm too busy right now. But you say, can I make an appointment? The fourth, fifth time, maybe you sit down, taste some wine finally. And that usually takes about a month.
Gotcha.
And something I'd add is there's no contracts or anything like that, except for maybe national accounts. So that would be, you know, if someone, you know, let's
like a chain restaurant.
Yeah, so like Applebee's has a corporate beverage manager, and someone in my corporate office talks to someone in their corporate office, and I really have nothing to do with that. My company, and I should say this too, my company sells wine to Applebee's, but it's not one of my personal accounts, because I kind of work with more of our fine wine, smaller producers, smaller importers portfolio.
Gotcha. So is your job typically, I think of some salespeople talk about being field reps as opposed to, you know, let's say desk-based representatives. It sounds like you're out in the field pretty much all the time. Is that accurate?
That is very accurate. I usually take care of any administrative things and set up, you know, my plan for the day, print out any materials I need, chill my wines, pack my bag. That usually happens between 8 and 12 in the morning. And it doesn't always take 4 hours. Sometimes it takes four and sometimes it takes one. And then my real go time, I'd say, is about 12 to 5. So okay. Catching people during lunch, catching people in between lunch and dinner.
Right, when they're there but not super busy.
Exactly. So, and 12 to 1 is typically not a great time, but it is a good opportunity to go to one of my accounts and have lunch there and spend some time with them. And in some cases, to be seen is all you need to keep a relationship healthy.
Sure. And as you said, this includes checking up on current accounts as well as new.
Absolutely. And the one theme that I'm positive you heard throughout all sales-based people that you've spoken with is that all that matters is the relationship and the trust. And
yes, I've heard that before.
even if you're selling a piece of software in 5 minutes, they won't buy it if they don't trust you. And that's a different challenge. And then building a huge contract over 6 months, it's the same thing. And everywhere in between, I'd like to think that my wine knowledge or my skills as a salesman are what make me successful, but really it comes down to people buy from people they like. So your goal is not just to be technically proficient at sales and wine and everything that comes with that, but also to win over a friend or a business relationship.
Right. That makes so much sense. Hey, just curious, sort of what's your time split roughly between maintaining your current customers and seeking out new business?
I would say 75 old business, 25 new business at this point. And with old business, I include going to accounts that I sell to and showing them new things.
Sure.
So if we're talking about, and that even might be more of a 90-10 split when I really think about breaking it down that way.
Gotcha.
My goal is to sell into 4 new accounts every cycle.
Because every 2-month cycle.
Exactly. And that's it. Like I said, it usually takes about a month to even get them to taste with you, and most people don't buy things on the spot anyway. So even after you get that tasting, there's a lot of follow-up required to get them to pull the trigger.
Sure. And a typical day, how many places are you visiting?
A typical day, it varies by day of the week. On Mondays, I usually go to my office, which, like I said, is an hour away. So that's my morning and early afternoon, and I'll try to go 2 or 3 places in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Tuesday through Thursday, I'd say, you know, in my territory, everything is so close. So You know, anything less than five places is not really a strong effort. And it doesn't mean you have to go in and stay there for an hour. You know, sometimes you just go in and say, hey, I was in the neighborhood. I wanted to say hi. Here's some corkscrews. See you later. You know. And then Fridays are kind of a wild card. Sometimes there's, you know, you anything administrative, I take care of then. If people want to taste or see me, I'll go. And we also tend to do staff trainings on Fridays because that's when restaurants have the largest amount of their servers present.
Sure. And it just one other question, because when you describe your job, it's all about this, you know, you're going into restaurants, you're talking with the bartender, other people there, you're building the relationships. But you did say how one day a week you go into the office, so what draws you to the office? What's that part of your job?
It's getting my wine samples. Very important.
Okay.
Yep, and, you know, we have monthly sales meetings as well, which is it's nice because I can see the rest of my team, which is small. So for our fine wine division, we have six people across the whole state, and we have a sales manager, a business manager, and our VP, and that's all of us. And the other divisions of the company are much larger because they sell much bigger brands like Tito's. Tito's vodka, I could say with confidence that 99% of the restaurants in this state use Tito's vodka, so they require a bigger sales force. But to get back to my point, those monthly meetings are nice because you get to see the people you work with, and they're really wonderful, and you know, we can talk through issues and taste new things together, and just kind of keep focused as a team.
Yeah, I was a little curious then also about the, can we call it continuing education? Like the last person I spoke with was a software support person, and he's kind of, you know, always doing, you know, new trainings or a new version of Windows comes out, and there's all these new certifications to study for and get. Is there something like, are you, let's say, do you sort of have your stuff, you're selling it, or are there sort of learning about new wines, or you expected to kind of do your own research, and are there certifications or anything?
There definitely are certifications, and the one my company provides is called WSET, which is Wine and Spirits Education Trust, and it's based in London. And they basically have different levels of certification. So one being a very, very basic wine knowledge of, you know, maybe I actually didn't even take it because it's really for someone coming in with no experience. But, you know, I'd imagine just the basic, you know, maybe five white grapes, five red grapes, wine grows in France, Italy, Spain, America, Australia, New Zealand, just really simple things like that.
Sure.
I'm doing the level two now, which I could have tested out of, but they just like everyone to do it, which is fine. And that gets a little more complicated with breaking the regions down into smaller pieces, adding more grapes in, adding winemaking process, some of those things. And then I will have an opportunity to take level three, which is where things tend to get challenging, even for people with experience in wine. And I imagine that's something I'll do. They're pretty expensive classes if you try to go on your own. So I think it's a nice opportunity that they provide.
Or your company provides or pays for the classes.
Exactly. And I'm not sure how much they are, but I think they might be $800 to $1,000 for a, you know, all the materials and the instruction and the test.
Yes, doable on your own, but definitely more fun if your company pays.
Absolutely. So that's one practical piece of education. But beyond that, during those monthly meetings, we do have our suppliers come in, and they present either new wines or do product refreshers. So it's a good opportunity to ask them questions about how the wine is made or anything else. And I think what really drives my team in particular is just our thirst for knowledge about wine and in general. And the thing that I love about wine is that you can never master it fully. Even master sommeliers know that there's just so many nooks and crannies in the world. You always can try something new. You really can always find something that you haven't had before if you look hard enough or travel.
Plus, rumor has it, doesn't it even vary by year?
It absolutely does, because wine is an agricultural product. It's a result of a fruit growing in fields, and climate most practically really can affect that from year to year.
Yeah, so it's like even if you know a certain, vinery, one year could be a little different from the next.
Absolutely, and that tends to be more the case with the types of wines I sell, because they want that variation. And a larger company like Gallo, they want it to taste the same all the time because that's what the consumers expect. And they do a great job of that. What someone who's paying, $40, $50, $60 for a bottle on the shelf really wants, assuming that they aren't just spending the money because they have the money and they want to spend it, but if they're really a enthusiast of wine, they're going to want to study, appreciate, but still study kind of what's in the glass and how it tastes and feels and something.
Make it distinctive.
Exactly. And we actually do in the wine world what we call verticals. So you take several vintages, they're called vintages, the year. So you take several vintages of one particular wine from one winery and taste them side by side. And to someone who, you don't even need to have a really sophisticated palate, but if you have a somewhat developed palate, you'll be able to taste the differences, not just because of what the crop was like that year, but also because of how the wine is aged in the bottle.
Right. Right, yeah, you're right. Way too many variables to ever master.
Exactly. So, so to kind of bring that back to what we were talking about, that just natural passion and thirst for more knowledge and experiences, it kind of drives us to always try different things. And something I miss about being on the retail side of things, at Bauer, is that I tasted wines from everywhere and everyone. And now most of my experience is just with the things I sell, because that's what I'm out there trying to work. And if I go out and I have something placed at a restaurant, I want to buy my own wine. I don't want to buy someone else's. So it gets challenging to keep tasting outside of your own little sphere. But
and about how many brands or how many different types of wine do you handle?
In my particular portfolio, we have about 500, 600 products.
That's a pretty large pen to be confined in.
It is, and they're amazing. One thing I always tell people is that for me, selling these smaller wineries that are very high quality, not necessarily expensive, but just in my opinion of a higher prestige, I wouldn't be in this field at all if I couldn't do this. If my choice was between selling our fine wine portfolio or another one of our portfolios that's more like selling a brand like Tito's, I would just find a different industry altogether.
Gotcha. Hey, you may have, you've sort of been answering this question anyway, but I'm going to ask it just in case there's something you'd like to add, which is, to do these interviews, you have to enjoy your field.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you've definitely been speaking about wines with a lot of passion, but Specifically, you know, your job itself, or at least, you know, the field you work in, selling, you know, fine wines. Can you articulate exactly what it is about that that you enjoy?
Sure. I view my job in two different pieces, and one is wine, and one is selling. So wine is kind of the gas that fuels the engine. I'm extremely passionate about really anything fermented. I think it's incredible. I think I've met incredible people who make it. I've met incredible people who sell it. The experience of trying something new, and also just being someone who loves, I don't like the term foodie, but I can't think of another one. So, you know, just loves the experience of different flavors and things you haven't experienced before. Mm-hmm. That's really what I'm most passionate about. When it comes to selling, as we'll talk about in a bit, I'm sure, this is my first sales job in this way. And it was really a risk for me because I'm not a very aggressive, pushy person, which is, I think, the stereotype of a good salesperson. But as I got into it, I realized that just the patience of building a relationship slowly and being truly genuine and truly caring about whether my accounts succeed, mm-hmm, is really more effective. So through that, I've become pretty addicted to selling. It's an amazing feeling. It really is a rush when you close on something, especially if you've been working hard for it over the course of a month or 2 months. So the wine piece I've always loved, the sales piece I wasn't sure about, but I'm really into it and on board with it now.
Great. So, all right, we'll move on to the next part of the interview, which is, as you said, you graduated in 2009. Terrible year to graduate.
That's true.
But here you are. You did allude briefly to a couple of your path before, but I'd like you to sort of put us in what was in your headspace, because it doesn't sound like you were saying wine salesperson.
No, and that's
by the way, what's your official title? I know it's sales, but the salespeople have all different titles.
Now let me see what my business card says. It says sales representative, but we have three different divisions, and my division is the fine wine division.
Wow, you're the first person in sales where their job actually says sales. Everyone
wow.
else is like, you know, business development or relationship specialist.
That's
or,
funny.
Yeah.
No, we're pretty straight up in this industry. We, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship because they know we're selling to them, but they need stuff to sell. So
absolutely. Okay, but point is, it sounds like you weren't, you know, there you were in 2009, probably not thinking fine wine sales.
No, and I think with maybe a very rare exception, what 18-year-old is really thinking about going into any alcoholic beverage field? You know, maybe they're drinking illegally. I think that's fairly common, but to actually be considering pursuing that as a career path, I have to imagine is extraordinarily rare. So everyone I've talked to in this field at any level has some kind of story about how they came into it.
Sure. So yeah, sort of put us in your headspace in 2009, or if you need to go earlier, you can. And then we'll sort of take both your headspace and what you were doing from there then to now, step by step.
Sure. So in 2009, I graduated in the spring, mm-hmm, and I already had my wedding date set for June 20th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I married my high school sweetheart, and we're still together.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, 8 years in June.
And could I ask, like, you went to Berkeley straight out of high school, right? You weren't one of those people who went to Berkeley at age 26.
Right. So I got married when I was 1 month away from turning 21.
Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy, huh?
Yeah.
And what we always say, and she would say this too, we'd marry each other again, but we wouldn't get married that young again, because there were definitely some challenges, which you can imagine. But she was in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Going to Westchester University. I graduated a year early, and we, you know, that was what was on my mind in 2009 in May. I need to graduate from music school and get a music job that pays $100,000 a year in a month, and we're in the recession.
Good
that's
luck.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yep. Which I'm sure everyone you've talked to in 2009 was kind of in that.
It's ugly. Speak. That was
yeah.
ugly.
It was brutal. So I, you know, we moved to Westchester because she had one more year of school, and the best I could do was Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a barista at Starbucks, quickly promoted to shift supervisor, as I rapidly rose the ranks in Starbucks in Westchester.
Do you mind sharing what you were being paid as a shift supervisor?
I negotiated a healthy, I think it was like $10.35 an hour.
Okay.
And
a little shy of the $100,000 a year.
Yeah, just missed it. We were below the poverty line our first year of marriage.
Wow.
But let me say this.
Hey,
for
what it's worth, same here, I think.
Yeah. No, that's it is what it is. But
yeah.
So I was working there 40 hours a week and doing a lot of music. I wanted to keep the dream alive. So I was close to home. I grew up near Westchester, so I still had my network of people from high school and all that. And we were in Westchester for a year and a half total. I'd say by 6 months, 8 months, I was gigging four nights a week, making about $400 a week on average. And I was teaching.
That's not bad on top of.
No, it's not bad. It's not bad at all. I was teaching lessons a couple days a week, and probably making like, you know, $150 a week from that. And then I was right by Westchester University, which has a great music program, and a lot of my friends went to it. So I also played on a lot of their recitals and things like that, because, you know, I was still in college mode, and that was fun. And
were you still doing the Starbucks at this point, or?
Yeah, so it was. So, like, a typical day for me, and keep in mind, my wife had no income because she was a college student. So,
right.
And we have always shared our finances, so I was supporting her at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So a typical day for me would be wake up at 4:30 a.m., work from 5 to 1:30, go home and take maybe an hour nap, pack my car, drive maybe a couple hours to Princeton, New Jersey, set up, play, leave there around 1 a.m., get home at 3, sleep for an hour and a half, and open Starbucks at 5 a.m. I would do that kind of thing at least two or three times a week.
That's brutal.
Yeah, it was tough and not sustainable. I think this is a piece of advice I always gave to once I worked at Berkeley again, which mm-hmm. is coming next.
Yeah.
This is the piece of advice I always gave to the students who were going to take a path like that. You have to look at it like you're starting a business, and every business needs capital. They need opening capital. So if you want to quit your day job, you need to save up a big nest egg. And I was close to that, and because like I said, if you work the math, I mean, I was doing okay. I probably was making around $40,000 between the two things I was doing. I mean, I was working 80 hours a week, but
Right.
If I had saved up some money and quit my job and really poured my time into developing even more music opportunity and business, I probably could have been, you know, comfortable with that. Not making a killing, but enough to live.
Right. Yeah, I've definitely spoke with people who totally hustled the music thing. And I mean, yeah, a lot of traveling they didn't necessarily want to do, a lot of gigs where they weren't totally enthusiastic about the music, but you can cobble it together.
Yeah, I did a lot of gigs where I wasn't enthusiastic about the music. I used to play and I used to be a ringer in our local community theater, and they would pay me so much money. It was incredible. They pay me like $100 for every rehearsal and like $150 for performances. It was crazy.
Sorry, what's a ringer?
Oh, it's like in musical theater in small towns, my high school performances and whatever. They want to comprise the bands of students, obviously, like high school students.
Uh-huh.
But there's just some parts that you need someone who can play the part really well, or it's just going to sound like a train wreck. So usually it's like a trumpet, you know, like some kind of brass player, some kind of woodwind player, maybe a pianist, just to fill in the more challenging parts of the score. So they would have me cover drum set and percussion. So it was like a 2-for-1.
Gotcha.
But yeah, that's funny because I really don't like musical theater. I respect the art. I totally understand the art. I think it's a worthy pursuit, but I just can't stand it. So it was like a lot of money for me at the time, but I had to endure something I didn't enjoy.
Sure. You do what you have to do, and frankly, as far as horrible jobs, there are ones far worse than that.
Exactly. Should we move on?
We'll move. So you're cobbling it together, and then it sounds like at some point you ended up back at Berklee.
Yeah. So
how'd that all work out?
My wife got kind of like a contract job right out of college, which was awesome, and it was paying a lot of money. But then she lost it abruptly, and we were like going in the hole because we had decided that we made it in life and got an apartment that was too expensive and so on and so on.
I'm sorry, contract.
So her degree was communications.
Gotcha.
And she was working as a technically independent contractor at a startup.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And when we lost that income, we were in trouble. So I was a work study in the admissions office while I attended Berklee.
Mm-hmm.
And I called my old boss, who I was close with then, and we're still really close now. He's a great friend, Brendan Gartland.
Okay.
And I begged him for a job, and he was just like, I can't just make up a job for you. But then that year in 2010, the admissions office, that was the year they redesigned it. Do you remember that? Were you around for that?
You'd be amazed how insulated us professors are from a lot of the administrative.
<Fair enough.
laughs> Well, I was there. I have no idea that they did this.
They gutted it. They gutted the admissions office and put down – they made it beautiful. It looked like – they wanted it to look like a recording studio, like you were walking into a good recording studio just as part of attracting a better student, you know? Mm-hmm. So – as part of that, they wanted someone to run and redesign the campus tour experience. So Brendan called me and said, I actually have something for you. He's like, you're very underqualified, but I think I can get it for you. And you just have to, you're going to have to learn really fast. So we took it, and my wife and I moved to Jamaica Plain.
Mm-hmm.
And I started this crazy job, which was the hardest thing I think I'll ever do. It was a big job. It was a job that should have paid 50% more and someone with 5 or 10 years of experience should have been doing. But it was me. I figured it out. I hired a bunch of tour guides. I had I had like 12 to 15 by the end. I completely redesigned the tour, and what you saw and what you heard and what the training was.
Gotcha.
You know, just everything. It was a huge job. I mean, it was creating a campus visit experience from scratch is really what it was.
Now, my question is, was this like a permanent job? Because it sort of sounds to the uninitiated like once you create it, you're kind of done.
Yeah, but which that's true. I mean, it got easier once that was done. But then there's still the managing, you know, 15 tour guides, which trust me, no one else wanted to do that. they I'm still in touch with a lot of them, and some of them are extremely successful in the field of music, and we're super proud of them because we really did. We got the all stars for these jobs. We
gotcha.
Got, you know, they're just very smart, very talented, and very passionate and driven.
The guides were Berkeley students, I assume.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we wanted the students of the college to share their experience instead of having, you know, someone else do it. We wanted prospective students and parents to be in front of students as much as possible.
Great.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, how long were you at Berkeley then?
For 3 years. And it the job got a bit too big, so I was frustrated. Mm-hmm. But it was still great, and it was a great opportunity. But I was kind of in a place where I was looking. And you know, I actually have to back up.
Sure.
When I was at Starbucks, this is when things really, really got fueled for the industry I'm in now. Our Starbucks was across the street from a brew pub, and it was like a local chain, mm-hmm. but every location had its own brewery. It's called Iron Hill. And I'm not sure how it happened. I think like I said, I worked 5 to 1. So my lunch break was at 9. And that's when brewers are weird. Like they start super early. They start like 7. They're crazy. And they just start the brew day, you know, whether they're going to brew once or twice, but they would come in for coffee. I started talking to them, and at some point they offered for me to go help them. So one Saturday I just went and I brewed a beer. I mean, I was like inside tanks scrubbing them with a headlamp. It's not fun. You know, you don't like sprinkle some grain and some water and, you know, have a few beers while you wait. Like, it's very demanding physical cleaning. But they loved me because I was so meticulous. And I scrubbed everything because I was just so happy to be there and be a part of it. And eventually I just started going over on my lunch breaks. So I just wouldn't, which again, was at like 9. But I'd just go over and help for a half hour.
Wow. Oh, paid or just for fun?
They gave me a lot of beers.
That works.
Yeah, a lot of growlers, but never paid. And you know, I kept in touch with the brewer who is just stupidly successful now. He owns a brewery called Tired Hands in Ardmore, which is like nationally, it has like cult status. It's crazy. And I'm not surprised because he's awesome. And he's a little bigger than to keep in touch with me now, which is fine because it's not like we were best friends. But I did keep in touch with him early when I went to Boston when he was starting that project. And he hooked me up with some people at Cambridge Brewing Company. And so, you know, it just kind of kept the passion going. And it was really active for me all 3 years that I was at Berkeley. So when it was time to look for a job, one day my wife saw that Bauer Wine and Spirits was looking for a marketing director, which I, with Brendan in admissions, I actually had a good deal of experience with marketing.
And can I just ask when you were looking for this other job? Because you had been, I mean, Starbucks to pay the bills, but you'd been working as a musician, and then you were at Berklee. Was your next job search still sort of focused on the music industry, or at this point were you going for anything?
I think I gave up on the music industry during those 3 years, and I thought I wanted to do higher education, which has happened to a lot of good people did that. They took advantage of the tuition reimbursement that you get as a Berklee employee. Mm-hmm. They went to Northeastern. They did a very highly regarded master's in higher education. And they're like, you know, financial aid directors or wherever at a variety of colleges in the area.
Sure.
So that's cool. And I thought I wanted to do that, but at some point I realized that I really didn't. I can't really explain why. I think maybe I just kind of seen all I needed to see.
And you said you're ready for something else.
Exactly. I mean, and I just wanted to be abundantly clear that that was a very valuable time for me professionally. I wouldn't have succeeded in anything I'm doing had I not been given that opportunity. And the people I worked with were very talented and did a lot of great things. So if anyone does end up listening to this or reading, I just want that to be clear. But but the frustrations of the job and the so-called higher ed industry were just kind of building for me. And I had this huge passion growing. And I just decided to apply for this marketing director job at this very tiny wine store.
And I was like, did they know who you were?
Or, no.
Okay.
No, they didn't. Someone I was friends with, who I went to school with, was working there as a part-time delivery driver, who, by the way, is a Berklee grad, is now making like crazy music software at the company in Cambridge. I can't think of it, but he's like a hardcore like computer programmer, which is awesome.
Awesome.
They loved this guy. Like, he was their, like, go-to, and I know from managing part-time college students, he was, like, their rock. So he was like, oh, this Jeff guy is pretty cool. And they were like, okay, we'll try him out.
Ah, so he put in the word for you.
Yeah, he put in the word. He's the man. And then, you know, that was, like, off to the races, and we probably grew their revenue over the couple years I was there, maybe about 20%, which was huge.
So you said your position was as a marketing?
Yeah, it was. I mean, marketing director, my joke was always, I was the director of no one.
Like, right.
It was the owner, the GM, two managers, me, a full-time kind of all-around delivery manager and awesome guy, and then a bunch of part-timers.
Gotcha.
So there was no one to direct. But I did come up with our marketing strategies on a pretty shoestring budget, and also was very active on the sales floor partly because that was just a practical part of the job. I mean, we didn't have a bunch of part-time people putting wine away. It was me and the GM and the delivery guys. And, you know, so when wine came in, that was something you had to do. You can't sell wine at a wine store if it's not on the shelves. So
right.
That was part of it. But also, I just got, again, the word addicted. I just got addicted to helping people pick out their wine. I just loved it. I loved describing it to them. And I loved when they came back and they said, you found something that costs less money than I was willing to spend. And I loved it, you know, and building that trust. That was just as fun to me as doing the marketing side of things. And we did some pretty cool stuff. I mean, we exploited this program through the USPS called, what was it called? I can't think of it, but it was like, you didn't have to buy a permit. and you didn't have to buy postage, but you could just target to very specific demographics mailers. And I was thinking, we had these, you know, our demographic was all these Back Bay brownstones. And I'm thinking about this age group of, you know, 50 and up who still get their mail every day and look at their mail. I was like, this is an obsolete technology or marketing strategy, but it could actually work. And it was one of the best returns we did, because it ended up costing about, after printing and everything, like 15 cents a piece. And these people would come in with their postcard for $5 off and spend like $200.
Nice.
So that was pretty incredible. That was probably my proudest moment. but you know, that kind of stuff was fun to me too. I don't really miss that doing sales now. I use principles of that all the time. Like my sales sheets are easy to read and have all the right information. You know, it's just kind of about eliminating any friction point or point of confusion. But, you know, I don't necessarily miss the being tied down to the desk and coming up with the plan and the presentation and all that kind of stuff.
Sure, sure. And it sounds like from there, the next step was at some point you and your wife moving down to Pennsylvania again?
Exactly. So, like I said, we're both from this area, not Philly proper, but from the suburbs, you can't really even call them the suburbs. My wife grew up with Amish neighbors in Lancaster, and I grew up like across from a horse farm in Chester County, like
okay.
Really, really rural. So, but still only about an hour outside of the city. So we kind of hit this point where Boston is very, very expensive. And even though we both had pretty good jobs, we were just treading water between my not so modest Berkeley debt and just the high cost of living in Boston.
Sure.
And we decided to move to Philly, which was the cost of living here is absurdly cheap for what a great city it is. We're closer to our parents again, and my wife just never really fell in love with Boston in the 5 or 6 years she was up there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we moved back, and she found a job. She moved a couple months before me, and I gave my notice. I gave like a couple months notice because I knew they'd be understanding, and I just started my job search and was searching frantically because, like I said, it's a weird market here because there's no off-premise opportunity. There's really just selling to restaurants, and that's all it is.
Right.
And, you know, as I said, too, I really didn't envision myself being a successful salesperson because I didn't really understand what it was, or I wasn't sure if I wanted to have that kind of lifestyle.
But you applied for that job anyway.
Well, I found it through some networking. It ended up coming from someone I had a professional relationship with at Bauer, knew someone in Philly who knew the VP who I work for now. And my resume just got passed along, and he called me out of the blue, and I went down and interviewed, and here we are. So it was pretty incredible because I was feeling very distraught, and I was ready. It was all the kinds of jobs that I told you I just wasn't interested in, like representing Bacardi or representing Tito's, which I'd just as much rather do something else because it doesn't really engage with the part of the industry that I'm passionate about.
Right. Right. Okay, and then so interview job, and here you are.
That's it sounds a bit too simple, but that really is what happened.
Hey, that's great. Great when it happens.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, move on to the third and final part of the interview. So my first question for you is, thinking back to your Berkeley experience, I'm talking about your education, we'll put aside when you then went to work for the admissions office.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say everything you did is well, as a student, and thinking about your current job, is there anything that you feel your Berkeley experience did particularly well to prepare you for what you're doing now, as opposed to going to college somewhere else?
The things that I find the most valuable are really practical skills. Like, as a performing musician, knowing how to get into a building where the front door is locked so you can set up your stuff for sound check, that applies when I cold call somewhere and they don't open for an hour, but I need to talk to someone. So instead of giving up, I find the kitchen door and bust in. or things like knowing that, you know, as a performing musician, you always take care of the guy at the door and you always take care of the sound guy. And it's the same thing here. You're kind to everyone you see because you never know who's going to be the next person who buys wine at that account. And they also, like I was talking about before, if you befriend a hostess, they might give you some really helpful information about when to find the person that you want to see. So these aren't really things you learn in class, but something that we always impressed when I was in admissions about the Berkeley education is just the environment that you're in. You're constantly surrounded by opportunities and events where you need to practice these kinds of skills, mm-hmm. especially as a performer. And, you know, showing up on time, it doesn't sound like anything, but it's something that I learned at Berkeley. You know, I tended to get more opportunities and better opportunities when I was reliable.
Right. Right. No, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I can't really think of, a composition class I took that helped me sell wine, but certainly the environment, which is unbelievably unique and really doesn't exist anywhere else, including other good music programs. It's just a real practical education in that way.
Right. Very cool. Okay, so we'll turn that question around now. Because obviously Berkeley gives one degree of Bachelor of Music, and you went there knowing that that's the one degree it gives.
Mm-hmm.
But all that said, when you look back at your Berkeley education, is there anything where you say, hey, it would have been really useful to have learned this while I was at Berkeley, and they could have taught it to me, and they didn't?
Hmm.
Anything they didn't cover or covered inadequately?
I think maybe just this may have changed since I left, because I remember some kind of mandatory first year course, but when I was there, you were lucky if someone sat you down and told you what an arduous, impossible career you had chosen. And I think that that's a very practical thing to discuss, because we all face the challenge of, okay, we graduated, how do we get going? You know, and just having someone tell you, hey, you need to be thinking about this now. Maybe you want to be a work study or something, but you're going to need like a few thousand dollars saved up to kind of get yourself off the ground. Or, you know, just talking about building a portfolio of, not a portfolio, but a variety of opportunities instead of just chasing one thing, you know, like performing with a few different groups and teaching lessons at a couple places. That's the kind of stuff that I had to figure out on my own. And it sounds very obvious, but I think a realistic approach to the challenge of being a professional musician is important. And frankly, the reason that we're doing this interview is because I probably graduated with about 800 people. Uh-huh. There are 800 musicians out in the world right now, and that's fine. That's totally fine. And like I said, a lot of my friends are wildly successful, which I think is awesome. But the reality is, it's not going to go that way for 800 people.
Of course. Yeah, the last numbers I see is that about 30% of Berklee grads are primarily working outside of music. And obviously, of those 70%, it doesn't say what their incomes are.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. Here's the other thing, and I think it relates to what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I realized during my first year outside of Berklee that I didn't have the passion or drive that some of my classmates did to really do that. And actually performing that much on things I didn't want to was kind of killing my musical soul. I had no resiliency for doing things like that I wasn't interested in doing, and earning money through music became a chore instead of a passion. I think the successful Berklee graduates who go into music are built differently. I was never the guy who sat and practiced for 6 hours a day. I would go to, you know, I would go to like Sunset Tap Room and try 5 different beers. You know, I think it was a gradual thing, but I realized that it was just programmed a bit differently than the people who really went for it and succeeded.
For what it's worth, before ending up in my current career, I tried to go into computer science.
Mm-hmm.
And like be a programmer, and I gave up on that when like I'd talk to fellow students and I'd be like, what do you do this weekend? And they'd say, oh, they got a new operating system in, so I came in and played around with it all weekend. And I'd be like, no, seriously, what do you do?
Yeah, it's yeah. True. I mean, I guess it's a valuable thing for some people to hear that. Yeah, I always felt like there was something wrong with me as a Berklee student. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I'd look at my peers and just be like, I know I should be doing that, but I just really don't want to. Like, I want to get good grades and everything, but I want life. Like, I have other things I care about and other things I want to do.
Mm-hmm. God, actually, if we could segue to that, to another question, which is, and there's no right or wrong answer, but what, if anything, is your current relationship with music?
In this very particular moment in
2017.
Time, yeah, nothing yet. This job I took was a massive commitment to get up and running. Mm-hmm. And it really was draining and took all of my time building these relationships and learning how everything works. The common advice in wine sales is it takes a year to get settled in, and it really is true. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot more free time now because I don't have to work as hard to hit those goals that we talked about earlier.
Sure.
So right now I'm listening to more music and more new music than I think I ever have in my life. So my interest in music is kind of at this whole new high, and at some point this year, and probably soon, you know, sometime in the summer, I'll find some friends and start playing again.
Gotcha. Okay, so next question I have for you is, you know, as you say, you treaded water for a couple years. You got in that pretty interesting job at Berklee where you learned a lot, and then you really found your passion for, you know, the wine industry. And played that, it, you know, got a job pretty quickly as you searched, and then this other opportunity, and you're holding your own. So, you know, you were on one path and then you migrated over to this one. I'm sure you're aware that a lot of recent Berklee grads have not yet found that path.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are people their last year at Berklee staring out into the big scary world going, oh my god, what's next? So for either or both of those groups, do you have any advice?
Yes, I would say don't be too hard on yourself, because Berklee students are so driven and they expect so much of themselves, and I include myself in that every failure, especially as a younger person in your early 20s, every failure just feels like the end of the world. And every, not knowing what's next feels like the scariest thing you can imagine. But if you are smart enough to get through Berkeley and graduate, you're smart enough to figure out the next chapter. So don't take everything so seriously, and don't think the world is ending every time something doesn't go right.
Sure.
And the other thing I would say is stop thinking about what everyone else thinks you should be doing as a musician, or, you know, whether that's your peers or your parents or society as a whole, what should a musician be? And just start thinking about what you're spending your free time doing. If you're spending your free time practicing, there's a good chance that you should be doing music as a career. If you're spending your free time on hobbies, maybe that's something to look at. Maybe that's really what you should be focusing in on and trying to develop into a career. Because, like I said, as an 18-year-old, wine sales is not really on your mind. And it's something that develops later in life. You don't stop growing when you're 18. I mean, in my 20s, I think I grew more as a person and developed more as a person than I did in my teen years. So you have to be open-minded to other opportunities and other things that might be around the corner.
Oh, that's great, and I love what you have to say about hobbies. Hey, specifically, I feel like you're somewhere around my 77th interview.
Awesome.
As you can imagine, very few people are going to listen to all 77.
Sure.
But you'll be there under sales, and then someone will poke over and say, he sells wine. That's cool. In other words, the people listening to this interview are going to be the ones who are thinking about wine sales, or maybe at least sales, as a potential career.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say for anyone there who's interested in getting into that field, do you have any specific advice for them?
Sure. I mean, sales in general is just so broad.
Sure. Well, let's even take it to, alcohol.
Sure. And it's actually not... It's not a silly thing to talk about, because so many people I meet at all levels, whether my age as a sales representative or VPs of wineries and wine companies, they came to wine through music somehow. It's not uncommon. I'd almost say like 1 out of 10 people have some kind of background in music.
Interesting.
It's really interesting. And I was just working with a winemaker yesterday who said some of his best wine lab technicians were music majors in college. Huh. It's really interesting. So it's not a far cry that someone would be considering this industry. And what I would say is it's not as glamorous as it seems from the outside. I am the, if you, I'm trying to think of another, a more appropriate metaphor than the one that comes to mind. But everything trickles down to me. I have no one to kick around. I am the end of all crap that comes down the river. From my buyers, from my company, from my suppliers. I'm it. So, it's not you walk around with your wines and you pour them for people and they're like, golly gee, this is great. I'll take a case. It is hard, hard work, but it is so rewarding. I get to drink things and go to places and meet people that I would never be able to afford or think about if I weren't doing this, and that's certainly a perk. But it's just important to know that it is definitely challenging, but you'll meet some of the best people that you'll ever meet. And you'll do some pretty amazing things. And if you're passionate about it, it's more than enough to outweigh anything negative that comes your way.
Gotcha. That's great. Well, hey, I just have one last question for you, which is, you have the mic and you're being recorded. So is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything we missed?
No, I mean, just, I think to summarize, I think Berkeley is a non-traditional education in the way that, it's just not like any other college. There's not homecoming dances, and I don't even know what other colleges do, football games or whatever. But you're just around amazing, passionate people working on a craft. And it's expensive, and I'm going to be paying for it for a while, but I really have a hard time saying that I would have the same skill set had I not taken that path. And I have to be grateful for that every day I go to market and sell things. So it's whatever you end up doing, it's a valuable education with a lot more transferable skills than you might realize.
Oh, great. Hey, thanks a lot, Jeff. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Me too. Thank you.
I mean, the world. So, hey, look for a message from me in the near future, and best of luck to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
Bye.